Welcome to ThinkTech Radio's Focus on Asia Tuesday. Today's segment is Issues and Insights, sponsored by Pacific Forum CSIS. And now your host, international business lawyer, David Day.
Well, good afternoon, and today is our Foreign Policy Geopolitics program brought to you by Pacific Forum, which you ought to know by now, because we do this every other Tuesday, is a world-class foreign policy think tank organization headquartered right here in Honolulu, and a member of our community's Bridge to Asia. And today on our program, we have the executive director of Pacific Forum, Brad Glosserman, with us. Brad, nice to have you here.
Again, it's nice to be back. And today we're going to, I think, test your audience's stamina, and certainly my own, with a program on economic policies, which be quite a challenge.
Well, I don't think that'll be a challenge, because it's going to, you know, got some very interesting things here. We're going to be talking about the economic shifts in China and Japan, and what are the implications for the global economy. And maybe we should start first with Japan, Brad. And what are the component pieces of the economic shift that maybe we ought to take a look at in Japan? Where is a good place to start there?
There really isn't a good place to start, I think, in this conversation. There are perhaps two or three, you know, pillars of the economic situation in Japan that are important. The first one is the debt problem. And, you know, while we're worried about watching Greece stave off impending euro doom, and as we're wondering if contagion will spread to Spain and Greece, you know, in fact, the most indebted developed economy in the world is Japan, with a total cumulative debt of about 220% of GDP.
So can you put that in perspective with the U.S.? U.S. debt is about, what is it,
80-90%? Yeah, it's not even 100%. So,
right.
But it's orders of magnitude worse. However, unlike most other, or virtually every other economy in the world, where the debt is held by foreign creditors, the Japanese own the debt themselves. So, you know, that reduces considerably the amount of pressure on the government to need to come to grips with this. And so, you know, the starting point, however, is a recognition that this is an extraordinarily indebted economy, one that has been indebted for a long time, and one could make the case that the debt levels are really what has, in so many ways, helped consolidate the spending, which has produced the debt. Let's be, I think, more specific, has you know, created this ostensibly egalitarian society. One that is where 90% historically of people have considered themselves middle class, where you've been able to gradually, or even not so much the case in the 60s, but pretty rapidly, raise incomes and create an extraordinarily prosperous society, and make sure that everybody, you know, all the boats were lifted as that tide went up.
And that was done through an export-driven economy through those years.
Yeah, an export-driven economy that was largely controlled to capital from the outside. But and you know, had the famous iron triangle of bureaucrats, businesses, and politicians, and you were able to, you know, make, I think, some pretty smart choices about where money was spent, even though that's, I suppose, somewhat heretical for laissez-faire economists and you diehard capitalists, and you know who you are. So you know, so the Japanese were, as the famous saying was towards the 1980s and 90s, was the only communist country the economy that actually worked. And so the Japanese, you know, managed to ride what was, in retrospect, a pretty flawed model, but to some pretty impressive heights. Early 1990s, and the Japanese, Ezra Vogel had written, Japan is number one, and if you recall, we were all terrified here that we were about to be overtaken by Japan, and that was the future.
And we were studying their management principles and how to do things in the Japanese way.
Social principles, et cetera. But it was largely a function of particular circumstances. So, but what ended up happening really is you had an extraordinary capacity to recycle money and to invest in assets that you know, produced wealth, or seemingly produced wealth, at least in this very particular external international economic environment. So, you know, factor number one, I think, is the debt that resulted from all of that. Second, I think, issue that's critical to understand Japan's economic situation today is its demographics. And quite simply, that the country is getting old and it's shrinking. And not shrinking because it's getting old and people are getting smaller.
Well,
but
you're not talking about the withering concept.
No, I mean, they're actually, the population of Japan is shrinking. And, the numbers, for what it's worth, the most recently, is that the Japanese, the total fertility rate last year was 1.39, which is about the same as the year before. The problem is that replacement, in other words, for the population to stay the same, you need to have a total fertility rate of about 2.07, I think it is. And it's been below replacement now for since 1975. So what is it, 37 years. The average age that women are having their first child is over 30 for the first time in history. And as the Japanese are so wont to do, they've made these great projections, and if current trends continue, the country will by 2060 have a population of about 86 million people, which will be roughly one third of the population smaller than it is today. So
that is a big problem.
Yeah, well, that's only part of it. I mean, part of getting smaller is obviously a shrinking base for productivity and for all of the elements of your economy that are generating dynamics. And while I don't mean to be an ageist here, and I apologize to anyone I'm offending by suggesting young people are more productive than old people. Sorry, Mom and Dad. The fact is that most of the studies show that you see more entrepreneurial risk-taking behavior from young people, that there just tends to be a greater dynamism and creativity. And also, quite frankly, historically, younger people save and older people spend. So you certainly don't have the, if you will, the rigor to generate the savings that, by the way, oh yes, we need to pay off our debt. So those two are related. And the other half of the shrinking population coin is an aging population, meaning that the average age of the Japanese is creeping up. It is already the oldest society in the developed world, and it will continue to get older and continue to get grayer. I think it's about 29% now, and it's anticipated to get up to about 36%.
So with that as background, with the demographics and the whole debt situation, maybe if we jump into the current situation here, there is this consumption tax. What is that all about?
Well, it's the Japanese are living beyond their means, and with a debt of 220%, and you need to raise your revenues and cut your spending as a way of getting your government to get your accounts in order. And so, just as in the U.S., we are proving, having our own debates about where our larger macroeconomic picture goes, the Japanese have been debating and trying to figure out where they want to go. Now, the Japanese have a fairly low tax system, tax base at this point. Obviously, if you're 220% in debt by every standard, you got low taxes. At this moment, there's a 3% consumption tax, and the Japanese would like to raise it. They have a 5% consumption tax.
It was from 3 to 5.
They went to 3 to 5 back in 1997, triggered, which killed one of their few periods of growth in the 1990s. And ever since, the Japanese have been incredibly skittish about increasing taxes, also because it happened to just, stick a knife through the throat of that particular government. And so for both political, obviously, and economic reasons, that they've been concerned about raising taxes. But the truth is that they need very drastically to come up with new sources of revenue, particularly as the workforce shrinks and the population shrinks. So the discussion now actually is, and the agreement is that the current government's going to pass a bill that will double the consumption tax from 5% to 10% in two stages. The problem, of course, one of the immediate problems is that no economist thinks that even a mere doubling of the consumption tax will solve their problems. So this is a politically unpopular and economically risky step that ultimately doesn't really solve your problems.
So one likely possibility is it throws the brakes on the economy even further.
Yeah, although it's hard to slow down an economy that's barely churning. I mean, I think the numbers I was looking, according to Morgan Stanley this morning, the last estimates I saw were that they're expecting about 1.8% growth this year, which is actually a and 1.6% next year. But that's actually a slight increase from the original estimates earlier in the year. So we're seeing a little bit of dynamism. I think some a little more productivity and production, perhaps. The Japanese economy, I think, has recovered a little more quickly than folks had anticipated in the aftermath of the March 11, 2011 triple catastrophe, and maybe seeing a little more growth from the other external markets that have, by and large, provided most of the energy that pulled the Japanese forward.
Brad, against this painful backdrop of the demographics and the horrendous debt problem, and when we come back from the break, let's talk about the impact of the post 3/11 Fukushima incident and the whole nuclear power situation in Japan.
How could anyone go away after that teaser?
We'll see you after the break. Stay with us.
Pacific Forum CSIS is a nonprofit, nonpartisan foreign policy organization affiliated with the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. From right here in Honolulu, Pacific Forum has, since 1975, provided analysis on current and emerging political, economic, business, and security issues for leaders throughout the U.S. and Asia. Also, the Pacific Forum Young Leaders Program brings young professionals and next-generation leaders from around the U.S., Asia, and Europe together to observe and participate in high-level, multinational dialogues normally reserved for senior policy experts. To provide your support for the Young Leaders Program and to send future generation leaders abroad to ensure peace and prosperity in the Pacific, please contact Pacific Forum at 808-521-6745. That's 808-521-6745. Or you can visit them on the web at pacforum.org. That's pacforum.org.
You're listening to Pacific Forum CSIS's Issues and Insights, part of ThinkTech Radio's Focus on Asia Tuesdays, with your host, international business lawyer, David Day.
We are back. And despite Brad Glosserman, the guest in the studio with us, his kind of humble introduction at the beginning of this program, we actually have a very fascinating discussion underway here about the economic shifts in China and Japan and the implications of those shifts.
And, but you sound so surprised, David.
Well, you know, I am fascinated by what you're saying, Brad, because you in the first section of this program, you talked about the very serious background that Japan faces with its demographic situation and then this overarching brutal debt the country is carrying. And in the first part of the program, we talked about this consumption tax. Let's shift into the nuclear piece now, if you're ready to go, and talk about that post 3/11 in Japan. What does that have to do with the economy and where does it take us?
Well, the energy piece of the puzzle actually is what kind of ties it all together and makes this, I think, a pretty intriguing discussion. And that is, you know, the Japanese have been quite good at ratcheting up their current account surpluses. In other words, the Japanese have pretty much since they've begun their you know, industrial juggernaut and the export, the mighty export machine of the 1960s that was the engine of Japanese prosperity and its leap into developed and post-developed country status. You know, the Japan is number one, and at one point looking like Japan is really prepared to overtake the U.S. It was a function of this extraordinary generation of money as a result of you know, incredible internationally competitive industries. And the Japanese were famous and infamous for generating more exports than imports. You know, we had all these huge trade squabbles with the Japanese in the 80s. Remember the...
Sure.
Yeah. And we can all go through the incidents. And so they built up this huge current account and trade surplus. And it was much more money that they were taking in than they were spending. And that money was being used in many ways to service this great debt. It was the means by which the Japanese managed to keep their keep the engine of their economy and their, keep their...
They were staying afloat on that.
Yeah, paying their bills. Now, what's interesting is in the aftermath of the Fukushima accident on March 11th, what you've seen is the Japanese have subsequently shut down all of their 54 nuclear power plants.
All 54.
All 54 are now out of operation, which meant that 30% of the Japanese energy supply was gone. Now, that creates difficulties in its own right. But so what the Japanese had to do last summer in particular was come up with ways of making up for that shortfall. And, of course, what you had was air conditioners turned off and people were going around in short sleeves. And as they called it, you know, cool biz and super cool biz and extended cool biz, depending on what time of the year it was. And similarly, what they had to do was they started to actually import and buy oil and natural gas to make up for the nuclear energy that they lost. Now, when you buy on short notice like that, obviously you don't forget the most favorable prices on the international markets. They were paying pretty high prices.
Right.
And that just absolutely took a chunk out of that vaunted surplus. All the money that the Japanese were saving, building up to pay their debt that had been generated by their exports, was now being under, that pile of money was being reduced to pay for energy imports substantially. So what happened for the first time is the Japanese have actually passed into deficit. And obviously the question is whether this is a structural shift or whether it can be replaced. One of the more interesting pieces of news of the last week, literally, in addition to the report of the political deal on the consumption tax, is the fact that the Japanese have finally, one of the municipalities has agreed to restart the first nuclear reactor that is in the post-Fukushima era.
It's a big shift.
Big shift. Well, because the government has officially said that it's going to phase out nuclear energy. Now, that was, whether that was just the high dudgeon of in the aftermath of the Fukushima accident or whether that's a sustainable policy, I mean, clearly no one in the business community, perhaps the industrial elites, are clearly, are think that this is just unrealistic and fantastic, as in fantasies like fantastic.
Right, right.
But clearly there's a very, very powerful popular sentiment to turn away from nuclear energy. There's great mistrust of the government and of the what they call the nuclear village, which ran and regulated those industries.
So you've got a popular opinion turning away from nuclear, and yet the need to replace nuclear in order to service the debt.
Right. Well, or probably not even just to replace it, but the need to continue it. My sense would be that you probably cannot generate sufficient energy from anything else other than, say, fossil fuels, but then that undermines Japan's claim to be a leading country in the context of global warming and greenhouse gas emissions. Remember, the Kyoto Protocol
from
Kyoto.
Yeah, okay.
And so the Japanese have made clean air and clean energy one of the pillars of their international presence for the last 20 years now. And that would require them, if to give up nuclear would really require them, I think, just to write that off completely.
Boy, what a catch-22.
And it also goes, of course, to their sense of vulnerability and their sustainable energy policies. So the Japanese now are trying to figure out, they're restarting some of their nuclear plants, and it's not clear how many of them. But that what the powerful impact of this reduction, if you will, in the current accounts and the need that these new economic, if you will, the balance books, have thrown into very, very sharp relief the need for the Japanese to face these problems. And so I think there's a clear relationship between the nuclear problem and the consumption tax. But again, that's not a solution.
Really?
What is intriguing, I think, a dimension of this which is also related to it, is the Japanese interest in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, this free trade agreement that the United States has been pushing.
And they were never interested in a free trade agreement, as far as I know, up until recently.
That's a little overstated. The Japanese have probably been interested in a political level with a free trade agreement with the Americans, especially since we concluded one with the South Koreans. But it's been primarily a political statement rather than a truly economic one.
Right.
And frankly, politically undoable given the strength of the agricultural lobbies in both countries. But what's interesting now about TPP, as it's known, which is intended to be sort of a gold standard of trade agreements.
And for our listeners, this is a free trade agreement that's currently being negotiated between, what, seven,
nine
eight,
countries.
Nine countries
okay. at this moment.
In our region.
And the Japanese were ostensibly, they're very divided about this. I mean, frankly, many people in Japan see it as a plot, as a conspiracy, a device to get the Americans to dominate the Japanese economy and to force, in fact, certain changes on the Japanese. And this is intriguing because, I mean, sort of a dark a window under the dark side of the Japanese soul, I suppose, and the readiness to see the Americans as being this, you know, heavy force to influence their future. But the Japanese are also, I mean, I would make the case that the Japanese economy has essentially stayed in the rut that it's been in for the last two decades precisely because the Japanese have chosen not to make the changes that TPP would force on them. And there are, frankly, industrial managers, bureaucrats in some of their high ministries that are responsible for these issues that would actually want Japan to join precisely because it would force modernization.
Okay, so for the benefit of our listeners, Brad, give us just one example, just one, of a change that Japan joining the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, might force upon
It would force the liberalization of agricultural markets.
Okay.
It would break the back of some of the agricultural lobbies that have essentially held back economic reform in Japan. Now, mind you, the Japanese are no more beholden to these than the Americans or the Europeans are. Everyone's got their particularly powerful constituencies. But the point is precisely that the economic managers, bureaucrats, say that these international deals are a way to force change on the Japanese that they can't do themselves. But anyway, to tie this together, where I was going with a lot of this, is that TPP is seen as a way of tying the Japanese more closely to the Americans at a time when, say, China is becoming a real concern, a strategic concern, and a strategic threat and shadow, that this is a way not only of ensuring that Japan and the United States stay tightly coupled, but it's a way of getting the Japanese access to our oil shale. I mean, the Americans now, we've shown the most growth in energy output to the point where people are actually discussing.
Interesting.
At the OPEC meeting last week, there were discussions about whether or not OPEC is on its last legs precisely because of the American production of oil and natural gas and shale oil is perhaps breaking OPEC's hold on global energy markets. And again, what we've also seen in the last 24 hours is both Canada and Mexico announcing that they will join the TPP negotiations. So
now we go from 9 to 11?
12, perhaps.
Wow.
But what's also interesting is currently, I think, TPP represents, 9% or so of the global economy. You add Japan, you add Canada, you add Mexico, it jumps up to 26%.
So let's restate for our listeners, Brad, how does this TPP involvement by Japan impact the economic shift that's taking place in the country? And think about that.
We'll take
it on after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to the Wall Street Business Network Pacific Forum's Issues and Insights. I'm David Day, and we'll see you after the break.
You're listening to Pacific Forum CSIS's Issues and Insights, part of ThinkTech Radio's Focus on Asia Tuesdays, with your host, international business lawyer David Day.
We are back, and you can join the conversation by calling us at area code 808-296-5467 if you dare on this topic. Boy, this is really something. We're talking about some really interesting shifts in the Japanese economy, and we'll get to some that are taking place in the Chinese economy and kind of what the implications are. So right at the break, we were talking about Japan's involvement in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a free trade agreement currently being negotiated with... It was
nine countries originally.
And jumping to 12 in the Asia-Pacific region. And the question I want to put to you, Brad, is what is the impact of this Japan joining the Trans-Pacific Partnership on its economy here? How does this fit in with our discussion?
Sure. Actually, you know, even though I'm pretending to play an economist on this particular show, we fancy ourselves strategists at Pacific Forum, and some of us actually are, as opposed to merely fancying. But so there is a dimension to this economic piece that I think might make it a little less academic for your readers, and I think our listeners, and it might make it a little more interesting. We've been talking about this economic agreement, this Trans-Pacific Partnership, as a device that will force the Japanese to make some choices about modernizing their economy,
right,
some reforms on them. It will similarly offer them new opportunities in the context of access to resources, particularly energy resources that come from Canada, the United States, under preferential terms that would help ease the particular economic situation that they're in, the one we discussed
right
earlier with the rising energy costs caused by the changes of the nuclear policy. Now, what's equally important is a strategic dimension, meaning the Trans-Pacific is precisely that, a Trans-Pacific, something that spans both sides of the ocean. And it is an attempt, in very many senses, to more deeply embed the United States, I think, in the region itself, in Asia. You know, and this is, I think we've talked previously about the rebalancing, and we've talked about the way that the United States is refocusing. Pivoted, right. And the question, despite the fact that we're a Pacific power, as the president has said, you know, the fact is that there are questions about our commitment and our durability and whether or not we will stay engaged in the region. And economic ties are one way of ensuring the more deeply we embed ourselves there. So for Japan in particular and for other Asian nations, TPP is a way of ensuring that the United States stays engaged. And the Trans-Pacific component of that engagement is a counterbalance to an East Asia-specific integration process as well. And most recently, we've seen in the last couple of months, what we call a CJK, China-Japan-Korea trilateral economic integration effort, which is currently... they've just announced that they will, and I believe they just signed, an actual trilateral investment treaty between the three of them.
Okay, okay.
And that will then lead to the beginning of a study and hopeful conclusion of a trilateral free trade area among the three. So what you're seeing is the consolidation and the further pursuit of the integration of East Asian economies, those three, and then there are 10 more in the South and the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. Those 13 countries are creating an Asian community that ultimately at some form may take some shape like an Asian Union, like the European Union, discounting all the problems that the EU is having right now.
But a trade area.
Yes. And what's important for our purposes is to recognize that this East Asian association, if you will, this East Asian grouping, doesn't include the U.S. So there are fears that that becomes a trade bloc, just as there were fears, quite frankly, when NAFTA was born 17 years ago, 1994.
That North America
ago,
became a trade bloc.
It would become a trade bloc.
Sure.
In fact, some people see this as the response to that.
Okay.
The EU, then NAFTA, and then this Asian unit. So what the TPP is an attempt to provide, if you will, a strategic counterweight to this purely East Asian grouping. So what you're seeing is a deeper, you know, integration of these Asian economies and then a thickening of the ties to the U.S. to make sure that we stay engaged. Now,
okay.
So this is both a political and an economic process. And you know, it's the Japanese pursuit, let's say, of the Asian element of this, you know, it's driven precisely by the fact that this is a country that's shrinking in size, that its currency is incredibly strong. And so the Japanese are feeling compelled to look for new investment opportunities. And quite frequently, they're finding them in China. So, you know, this trilateral investment agreement is a reflection of a need by the Japanese to better protect those investments. And the Japanese are driven by an economic and demographic necessity at home to look for those opportunities and to buy up new properties, if you will, as they get older, as their labor prices go up, they're discovering that they have to go out in search of new investment opportunities overseas to maintain their own economy.
So what you're saying is that the TPP provides, on one level, a critical strategic link in the region for Japan, but in terms of its economic benefit to the country, one of the principal drivers for Japan is access to less expensive energy in the North American market.
Absolutely.
So, and you did in just a moment ago, Brad. I mean, this is fascinating. You mentioned that the
confusing too.
It is confusing, but it is fascinating at the same time. You talked about the high high yen value, and I guess at one level that discourages Japanese exports. That cuts against the resurrection of their export machine. That's a motivation for them to participate in the free trade agreement TPP. Mm-hmm. But is there a benefit on the high yen side to Japan?
Well, you know, in theory, if the Japanese were to do this right, what they would be doing is they would be buying valuable properties outside of their country, and then as their own economy or their own population shrinks, they don't have the people that can do the manufacturing work. So what they do is hive off, if you will, the low value ends of this process, keep the highest, very highest end of the value added chain at home, and then essentially live off the rents from the purchase of properties, investments, etc., in other countries. The profits that they repatriate from, the manufacturing that Toyota might have done in Toyota City that they're now doing in Shanghai or Ohio or in Germany. You know, wherever else they've decided to, they see investment opportunities.
Okay,
so, in theory, that works out really nicely. In theory,
sure. All right, and so let's follow the theory one step down the road here. The investment opportunity search that Japanese do tends to land them in China, does it not?
Quite frequently. I mean, earlier in this century, in the 2002s, 3s, and 4s. You saw that the Chinese were being identified as primarily, there was a number of very famous magazine articles, the covers of Daimondo, which was one of the Business Week of Japan, where the China threat, but the China threat wasn't a military threat at that point. It was an economic threat. It was that Japanese companies were recognizing that this is where the future of production was, and therefore that you were hollowing out Japanese industry. So primarily the Japanese have moved heavily and have long time actually frankly been investors in China, but I think the numbers a decade ago and even less were 40-50% of Japanese economic growth as the economy has recovered has been as a product of the profits that they've generated from Chinese businesses. However, the Japanese are also very concerned, as are most investors in China these days, about volatility there, about rising prices, about inflation, etc., and consequently they've evolved what they call a China plus one strategy. But then you have to be careful about that. One of the places that the Japanese have put an inordinate amount of money and investment, and predating the last decade, but going back to the 70s and 80s when the Japanese first started having the yen inflate in value or become stronger such that they were losing their competitiveness on international markets, was Thailand. And we've seen horrific flooding in Thailand for the last, 6-8 months. And consequently, Japanese production facilities have been cut down there, taking a huge loss, which, of course, then follows at the same time several years of political unrest. So you've got to be careful where you put your money, even when you're not putting it in China. Investment opportunities are always a risky proposition, and Japanese are discovering.
Well, absolutely, and you're one of the things that we'll get to in the final section of this program is the China economy. But as I listen to you, what I hear you saying is that this enormous debt that Japan is attempting to service, in part, the servicing of that debt, it really is lashed to the Chinese economy.
It's certainly lashed to external economies. I mean, the end of the day, the debt is huge, and the Japanese are going to have a really difficult time paying it off. What you're seeing, I think, as a result of developments in the last couple of months, a year and change, is that it's what was taken to be, I think, somewhat a middle and longer-term problem is being pushed forward on the horizon to become a short and middle-term problem. I don't see how the Japanese, given their circumstances, are going to be able to service this debt. At some point, they're going to have to inflate it away. And I just don't see that, the problem is going to be how the Japanese as a society will deal with that, given at that point it was an incredibly gray, older society. And ultimately what you're going to have to do is come up with ways to pay back. You have a great debt to the citizens, billions and billions of dollars, you're going to have to pay it back. But the only money that you've got is essentially the borrowings from these Japanese citizens as well. So I don't know how they're going to be able to withdraw. The Japanese will live off those savings and at the same time generate sufficient capital to service the debt itself. Looks to me like you've got a severe crisis somewhere down the line.
Let's set aside that crisis for a moment and jump into another one. Let's talk about China now.
Yeah, it's enough to make you hesitate, isn't it?
It is. So how, from your perspective, how are the Chinese trying to... Well, I'll tell you what.
Saved by the bell.
Saved by the bell. We'll pick that up after the break. Stay with us. We're talking about economic shifts in China and Japan.
You're listening to Pacific Forum CSIS's Issues and Insights, part of ThinkTech Radio's Focus on Asia Tuesdays, with your host, international business lawyer David Day.
We are back, and we are talking about economic shifts in China and Japan with Pacific Forum's Executive Director Brad Glosserman. And right before the break, we started our transition into looking at how the Japanese and Chinese economies are related in this situation that we've got at the moment.
I've left you befuddled.
It looks to me like the Japanese are in part, at least in part, relying on China, the Chinese economy, at a time when all the indicators are that economy is in fact slowing down. I mean, am I missing something here?
Not really. I mean, you're a pretty smart guy, David. You can usually put those pieces together. I mean, yes, the Chinese economy is slowing down, partially by design. The Chinese have averaged, 9% growth now for several decades, frequently exceeding 10, 11%. The targets for this year, Chinese growth are about 7.5%, and you're expected to have a 7% average over the 5 years from 2010 to 2015. That raises some real intriguing questions for the Chinese, because it's long been an item of faith that you have to have 8% growth just
to maintain
employment, which raises some interesting questions that we'll come back to. If I'm coherent, if I can be logical in this argument in this segment. So the Chinese economy is slowing down as, frankly, the world slows down. And the Chinese concern really is whether or not they will be able to generate the exports that are required, to keep this growth rate going. The problem, actually, the Chinese can generate the exports. They can always make
Somebody's got to buy them.
That's the problem. I mean, look at what's going on in Europe. Look at what's happening in the United States, the prospect of double dip. You're seeing consumption just slide. And so the Chinese are essentially seeing their markets dry up. And as their markets evaporate, then you certainly don't see the Chinese finding the pull, if you will, that keeps their economy moving forward. The real hope, what most of the economists talk about, is what the Chinese need to engage in some rebalancing of their own, a pivot of their own, if you will.
Okay. All right. No, but that makes sense, to shift out of this investment mode.
Well, yeah, yes. I mean, whereas the United States talks about a pivot to Asia, what the Chinese are talking about is a pivot in economic focus away from production and investment, which has consumed historically about 48% of gross domestic product.
So this would be a shift from an export-driven economy to an internal...
Right, one that's more consumption-oriented. And that's tough. It's difficult because it means that people have got to be prepared to spend money, which is not necessarily what the Chinese are conditioned to do. The Chinese have no safety net. So you see extraordinarily high savings rates in China because people don't have pensions and they're always preparing for your old age
or something.
Well, old age more than catastrophe. I don't know if old age is a catastrophe. Maybe you should tell me, David, being the more senior of the two. But number one, whether or not you can generate the consumption, and number two, whether or not you actually have a middle class that's capable of spending that money. And the Chinese are building a middle class, but it's still a slow process, and you've got an incentive structure that is built to, frankly, suppress consumption and to favor production, because that's aligns with the interest of the party, which is generating jobs and keeping the export machine running. There isn't a great deal of faith in terms of having consumers spend money, which, quite frankly, is the same way that the Japanese were when they were building their their successful economic machine as well. So this, they're taking a page from the Japanese model.
So the consumer really has, for investment purposes, the consumer has a choice the practical matter of investing in real estate or making some kind of bank deposits, right?
Yeah, I mean, well, the consumers, don't have a great deal of options. And the government has essentially suppressed interest rates as a way of encouraging the banks to lend the money out rather than attract a lot of deposits. And the result of that, of course, has just been that you have a great deal of, you have both a search on the part of Japanese to find, or I'm sorry, Chinese, as you said, to find other ways to get money. If the banks aren't going to pay them, what do? Well, they invest in real estate because that's historically what the Chinese have always seen that as always a way of making money because land prices never go down.
Which they are now.
Well, you've got bubbles in virtually every real estate market. And also you have them moving into what they call a shadow banking system, which is a parallel banking system that offers them higher returns on investment, but frequently through shady, if not flat-out illegal means. And so that creates a great deal of instability in the economy. And that's, to me, the most interesting question that we face as we think about China, which is the Chinese economy has performed in extraordinary ways, largely since 1991. Or 1992, when Deng Xiaoping made his southern tour and really pushed the reforms, and you've seen the explosive growth. But what you've never seen in China during that time is a serious economic shock. And so, one of the more interesting discussions when we talk about the rise of China, the rise of the West, the decline of the United States, the U.S. has experienced with great regularity, sadly, economic shocks. We've demonstrated, in fact, every decade we've had one or two. This is a bad one, but we've had pretty nasty downturns in the last, since the 1970s.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But the fact is that we know how to deal with them, and we have responded to them, and we've recovered from them. We've demonstrated a real resilience in the United States.
Well, what do you see on the Chinese side?
I see you're jumping the gun on me, David. I was going to get there, and the fact is that we don't know if the Chinese economy is going to be, if the society is going to be as resilient as the United States has been. This is a generation that has never known a downturn. This is a generation that has never seen its housing lose value. It's never seen a shocking loss in the stock market where people are playing stocks every single day. Mm. And it's not, where perhaps the old people like yourself in China. The ancient ones. The old, the wizened and wise ones that have lived through the Cultural Revolution know that things are so much better, and even if they get worse, will still be better. This generation doesn't know that. And so, to me, the most important question will be how the Chinese economy or the society deals with a substantial downturn, how it handles a shock. And truthfully, I'm not terribly optimistic about this, and I don't think the Chinese government is either. I hope we don't find out. That's why the discussion frequently in the context of among economists is whether China will have a soft landing as it renegotiates this shift and tries to navigate through the particular treacheries of external economic problems. You're seeing the Chinese making a lot of investments now in Europe as a way of creating some stability. Now, they're not going overboard, but they're certainly making their presence known, and they're trying, of course, to extract political rewards for being, acting in their own self-interest. But the bottom line really will be how this government is forced. And don't forget, the Chinese have a new government coming in. The fifth generation takes power later this year, so it will be untested. 70-80% of officials will be changing jobs. So you'll see a largely untested group of people being forced to deal with an unprecedented economic situation, and to me, what's really one of the more revealing statistics is that as much as we have focused on and highlighted the extraordinary growth in the People's Liberation Army and the military in China for the last, 15, 20 years, for the last 2 years, if not three, and I think it's just two, the People's Armed Police have actually, their budget has been larger than that of the PLA. And that speaks to me of an insecurity and a concern about domestic unrest.
And they have had serious domestic unrest over the last few years.
150,000, 180,000 incidents each year, depending on, and the Chinese, of course, I think, define down an incident, meaning it's just a few people gathering in front of a protest or in front of a public office. It qualifies as a domestic disturbance. But clearly great sensitivity and great concern about what happens if the economy is incapable of rebounding or is badly shaken.
So this economy that the Japanese have kind of lashed themselves to in part, you seem to be very troubled, Brad, about this issue of resiliency, and I can see why.
But resiliency always keeps me awake at night. First of all, I take a little issue probably with the notion of the Japanese lashing themselves to the Chinese economy. I mean, I think they're intertwined, but that's natural. I mean,
sure.
If you look at their relative sizes, you look at their relative capabilities, the fact is that Japan is ultimately dependent upon external markets, and the Chinese are the closest, the biggest, in some ways complementary. And so how the Japanese will accommodate, deal with China successful or failing or troubled China is a challenge, but it's in many ways it's out of the Japanese hands. And it's out of all of our hands. And so, you know, we all need to be prepared for a China that is encountering difficulties, because my guess is it is not a society that will merely turn its attentions inward. It will engage its neighbors in new ways.
Brad, you see the Japanese economy with its debt load and the overall situation sufficiently fragile that a China that takes a hard landing...
Takes it down? No, Japan's got its own problems.
All right, well, we're almost out of town, but make it quick. We're almost out of time.
I think Japan will surprise us in some ways. And I think that the tradition notion of Japan as being, you know, we've looked at it as the sick person of Asia, but maybe we need to reconsider.
That's all the time we have. Thank you very much. Have a safe drive home, and thank you, Brad. Great discussion.
Always a pleasure.
Good night.
Thank you for listening to Pacific Forum CSIS's Issues and Insights.